All right, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? I can't really hear you. But I want you to know that I'm somewhat interested in how you're doing, you know, out there. Greetings and salutations. I'm Scott Horton. The lying liars are on the Capitol Hill telling lies. Did I read a tweet somewhere that said they weren't sworn in? It's not like they'd ever be held accountable for... Hey, lying to Congress is fine as long as you're in the executive branch. Sworn or not, everybody knows that. But I guess it's fun to see when officially they go, well, I better not swear them in since today's show is going to be all about lies. Now, if I was smart, I would just turn up the audio and listen and read Marcy Wheeler on Twitter. Twitter.com/EmptyWheel.
Short question. Then.
For logistics, I'll try to give members a 30-second notice on their time. Thank you.
Okay. A short question. Currently, the NSA is holding for 5 years the business record data. Many people have suggested that's too long. What, 2 or 3 years? What do you think about shortening a time, whether NSA holds it or some other entity holds it?
Our analysts think that somewhere around 3 years is probably the least that you could do. And so if we did that, it goes back to what Congressman Ruppersberger said. I think 3 years makes sense. That's what our analysts have come up with.
I thank you. I yield back.
All right, you know
Thanks,
what?
Mr. Chairman. And let me at the outset
well,
thank you
know.
For the leadership you've shown
this.
On this issue. And many others have been running and hiding. You've been out front, and I want to commend you for it. And General Alexander, let me, through you, thank all of the outstanding men and women that work for you, the tremendous job they've done.
All right, I don't want to hear Peter King. You know what? Here's what's going to happen. I'm going to talk about what I feel like on the show today, because that's what I feel like doing. And then tomorrow, I will bring you Empty Wheel. And hey, you can go read her yourself. But tomorrow, she's going to be on the show. She's at twitter.com/EmptyWheel. She's also at EmptyWheel.net. She's the brightest lady with the blog in the world. At least paying attention to things I care about. You may have some super genius who, you know, talks recipes all day or something. But when it comes to parsing the lies, well, when it comes to just parsing the truth of what the government is doing, especially on stuff like NSA surveillance, they just don't get better than that. Anyway, so she's going to be here to break it all down. What's the big deal? Oops. it is a big deal, but I don't want to waste my show sitting here listening to Peter King tell the NSA how great he thinks it is. The NSA is so great, how come they never stopped Peter King from raising money for a bunch of IRA bombers? Shouldn't he be in Guantanamo Bay right now for being guilty of the war crime of material support for terrorism? Of course he should, if there was such a thing as the law. Unfortunately, there's not law, there's just policy and excuses for the government to persecute people, that's all. There's no law. Or Peter King would be under the prison right now, instead of in Congress saying, isn't it right, Mr. Clapper, that you never did nothing wrong, did you? No, sir, I did not. All right, well... Think of all the things that they didn't stop from happening. Everything. Think of all things that happened that they didn't know about. Everything. You know, these guys who claim that they stopped 50 attacks have now narrowed it down to one. I'm talking NSA claims of what they've been able to accomplish with their illegal data mining. Well, sort of kind of legal. Data mining. One. And that was a guy trying to send some money to Somalia. Trying to send some money, like Peter King would have done for the IRA just a few years ago, raising money to send it off to terrorists in a foreign state. That's it. That's the holy hell terror chaos that they've prevented from raining down upon this society. A society which, by the way, I was explaining to people on September 11th and 12th and 13th, has a gigantic economy. Not that we're not buried under mountains of debt already, but still, is a huge society with just 1 zillion square acres. I forgot the exact count, but it's a lot. From San Diego to Bangor, Maine. That's a hell of a lot of country with 300 million people with, what, at least a couple of hundred? How many hundred major cities? Well, I don't know. Somewhere around 100 major cities, and then a hell of a lot of pretty good-sized towns, too. All kinds of industrial capacity and wealth and capital that's already been built up and saved up. There hasn't been mass violence here since the 1860s. Well, if you don't count, all, I guess, all the Indian Wars and everything. For 100 years straight, basically, there's been more or less peace. I don't mean that, you know, just peace. I just mean the mass chaos and disruptions that the rest of the world has faced. America's not in a hell of a long time. In other words, if they did a September 11th attack every day for a month, it still could not bring down our society. Only our own stupid overreaction could do that. And for all the cries about, oh, they attacked the towers to try to kill as many people as they possibly could, that's not right. It was a symbolic target, obviously. I mean, they did it during work hours, not at night. You got me there. They wanted it to hurt like hell and everything. But those are the twin towers of the empire. That was the symbol. One was nicknamed David, the other Nelson, for the Rockefeller brothers, the two most powerful of the third generation of Rockefellers. Who, of course, it was a Chase Bank, New York State swindle that built the towers in the first place, right? Everybody, state of New York guaranteed loans from the Chase Bank and all their corner cutting and everything else to get it done. And anyway, so they could have tried to, they could have attempted anyway to crash all four planes into the Hoover Dam or something. Something like that. They didn't do that. And I guess, you know, I don't know, if you have people hijacking and crashing planes every day, obviously wouldn't work after the first day of it, right? You'd have everybody fighting back like on Flight 93 kind of a thing. They wouldn't be able to get away with it after the, you know, initial surprise wore off that, whoa, hey, we're not going to Cuba and be home by dinner. They're going to crash this plane into something, so let's go ahead and try to fight them. But if they, you know, used magic or something to be able to carry out an attack on that scale every day for a month, that still wouldn't be enough to bring down America. And all they can say that they've saved us from is a guy who sent money out to people fighting on the periphery of the American empire? Man, that's a lot of bragging about nothing. That's a lot of spying on innocent people for no reason. Hey, that's exactly what the American people insisted they didn't want as soon as they learned of total information awareness in the first place, back in 2003 or 4, whichever, Admiral Poindexter. And all of that. That might have even been in 02. And the people said, no, they don't want that. You can threaten us all day, but no, we don't want total information awareness. We'd rather have something like the free society we sort of kind of remember having, sort of kind of. And they've gone ahead and done it anyway. 50 attacks! 54 attacks! I mean, 4 attacks! I mean, 1 attack. I mean, one guy sent money out to someone else. Boy, well, it's a good thing that they've kept complete files on all of us. As long as they've prevented one guy from sending a MoneyGram somewhere. Now, they tried to claim credit for this and that, but all those claims were debunked already. They tried to claim that they stopped Najibullah Zazi, but he was emailing a guy that they were already surveilling under old law. A terrorist-associated, Al-Qaeda-associated guy living in the United Kingdom. And that was how they found, who's this guy? Oh, Zazi, let's follow him around. Let's see what he's doing. So maybe then the NSA pointed their antenna at him or something, but so what? That's hardly a claim on thank goodness for them when they showed up second. All right, anyway. I'm sorry I'm not the world's expert on this. I need to sit and reread Bamford. I need to sit and just start in June and read everything Marcy Wheeler wrote three times or something and try to get it through my thick skull, all this technological stuff about what Blarney means and all this crap. It's hard for me. I don't know. I'm really good at trying to figure out, well, I don't know, really good. I'm sort of kind of all right at trying to figure out different political factions and what the stakes are and where they're, you know, what they're fighting for in the Empire's wars overseas and stuff like that. But all this, who's vacuuming up what in Section 207 and 1552 and 1441 and 1933 and I don't know, man, what? You lost me at 1984. Back in 1913. But I'm going to try to do my very best to read. And, you know, Marcy Wheeler, she gets down to the nitty-gritty and the weeds, they call it. Really digging through all the different pages of lies and all the different timelines and interpretating what it all means. Now, Robert Greenwald was supposed to be on the show today, but it didn't work out. Which is unfortunate because Robert Greenwald, he's a filmmaker. He's not Glenn Greenwald or associated with him. He's an entirely different Greenwald. He's the guy that made the movie Rethink Afghanistan about why not to surge into Afghanistan back in 2009. And he's made some other documentaries as well. I don't think they're all foreign policy. He made Outfoxed about how Fox lied you into war back in 02. That's a pretty good flick, actually. I recommend that. The cynicism of the propagandist on display in there is a lot of fun. But anyway, so he's got a new one called Unmanned, America's Drone Wars. And earlier today, he had arranged a hearing that was hosted by Alan Grayson, the Democrat out of Florida, who I've tangled with before. but Grayson held this hearing, and they brought a guy who's in the Amnesty International report whose mother was killed in her garden by an American drone. She was by herself, just gardening. And they waxed her. And I guess she wasn't completely by herself because her grandchildren were nearby and saw the whole thing, as her body was completely blown to smithereens. Little bloody pieces all over the place, scraped up and buried what was left of her. And this guy came to Washington, D.C. today, and they asked him questions, and he testified there. He sat at the table with Alan Grayson. He had an interpreter with him. He's just some poor schmuck from the SWAT Valley is all. He's just some guy just like you. And his story was that the American government killed his mother, exploded her with a remote control plane and a Hellfire missile. And I actually didn't see, I only saw the very last bit of it, and I heard reference to his children, who I believe were there, but I guess I didn't get to see any part if they talked or not. I'll try to go back and they have it on YouTube. Maybe I'll pass that around on my Facebook page or something later. Or if somebody has it, pass it around to me. But the guy's describing what it was like to lose his mother in this drone strike. And I think it's really important for people to see stuff like this. I mean, I know it sounds kind of patronizing and stupid in a way. But also at the same time, man, they do such a good job of making it seem like these people don't matter. They do such a good job of just going, oh, yeah, another drone strike in Pakistan. Anyway, blah, blah, sports, yeah, pop star, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they don't even talk about drone strikes in there. I mean, and in fact, the fact that they talk about pop stars and not drone strikes actually makes it seem like it's some kind of objective truth that it just doesn't matter what happens to these people. It's just like with this stupid debate about the National Security Agency. We're just supposed to believe that whatever the government does and whatever its agents do, well, they're only doing it because they love us so damn much. They have no other motive than protecting us and saving us. So if they murdered somebody's grandmother over there, I know that I mean, I can't really say I'm guilty of this in this case anyway, but I guess from time to time I'm guilty of this. No, you know what? I am guilty of this in this case. I am guilty of this in this case. This happened to me this morning. When I was watching this guy testify through the translator, I was looking at his face, and he's kind of a weird-looking guy. He, at least the way I remember it now, he had a little bit of a unibrow there. That's kind of weird. Who do you think you are? Bert from Sesame Street? And then his nose is kind of funny shaped, like if you mix a Central Asian with the son of a Greek or a Roman conqueror or something like that, you know? And then, I don't know. My brain, there's a part of my brain raised in Austin, Texas, that was trying to find excuses to deny this guy his humanity. That was a thing. Before, and look, I'm hell-bent against all intervention in any way and all this killing, and you know I have been this whole time, but I'm just telling you, I admit it. I'm like this. I'm an American. I've been told how exceptional I am and how little everybody else on Earth's life counts compared to mine my whole life. And so even as I am automatic, I already know this guy's story, that they killed his mother in front of his children. And I already know I'm 100% on his side. And I'm 100% I think the guy that pulled the trigger on that drone should be in the dock right now, as well as the President of the United States who made him do it too. And everybody in the chain of command between them all. War criminals. Grandmother murderers. The worst kinds of people on the whole planet. Real devils. Chosen ones. People who decided to be evil. And meanwhile, what's the, between my corpus callosum as my hemispheres fight, what's the dialogue? Well, there's something inhuman about this guy. There's something that doesn't quite look like someone I grew up with about him or something. There's some excuse here somewhere. There's got to be something about it, about him, that makes it okay to kill his grandma. Right? So I can accuse you because I'm accusing myself. I'm pointing my finger and there's four pointed back at me. We are all brainwashed from birth to believe if you kill somebody for this government, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Collateral damage. These things happen. Screw her and screw him. I can't understand a single word he's grunting. This weird foreigner who might be from Mars, as far as I can tell. This gook. This weird Haji, whatever, make up a name that makes him not a person. And then that goes for his mom too, right? Obviously came from something inhuman if he's inhuman. And so then that's the importance, though, of bringing him to Washington, D.C. and at least trying to put him on TV. They got three C-SPANs. But instead, you had to just stream it from Al Jazeera online. I guess NBC had a stream of it, too. But here's the point. The important part is that I knew when I watched the guy talking about his grandmother being killed, and then I heard the girl translating for him there, the young lady translating for him, I knew that, you know, all that stuff in my brain about how inhuman he is and how it doesn't matter is all wrong. And that actually, there he is, just some poor schmuck. You know, I guess, is that the difference between my thalamus and my prefrontal cortex? Or how exactly does that work? Is the right hemisphere versus the left? Half of me brainwashed, the other half valiantly fighting off my brainwashed half? Anyway, so good for Alan Grayson for bringing that guy to testify. And I'll try to get Robert Greenwald on. And I'm blowing the first break here, of course. Here, listening to Les a little bit of it.
Wiretap on... The leader of an allied country to be a...
Oh, that's the wrong damn button. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me heard it here. Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. The jobless rate in America keeps climbing. Food stamps and other social welfare spending continue to increase at an alarming rate. And the only thing that's kept this whole so-called recovery going at all is the Federal Reserve's inflationary printing press. Seems like 2008 might have just been a rehearsal for the financial crisis still to come. So now let me talk to you about this great video by Dr. Martin Weiss from MoneyAndMarkets.com. The video spells out how this disaster will affect you and create enormous financial opportunities if you know how to recognize a true diamond in the rough. Weiss shows when stocks have crashed and even gives the names of the biggest banks that are most likely to fail. Before you invest $1, take the time to watch this new video. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Learn from the experts how to evaluate these opportunities and start making better informed decisions that will lead to a better return on your investments. That's Dr. Martin Weiss at crisis16.com. All right, still on last Friday's bumper music here. I got to fix that. Oh, you know, that means the last break today is going to have a big error in it, too. Yeah, well, whatever, dude. Maybe you got fleets of interns, but I only got the one. Me. No, that's not true. I got the one, Adam. But his job is posting the interviews. And posting, you know, updating the website with the whole show archives and all that. Man, I remember years ago I had a job being a land surveyor. There's an entire Bill Hicks bit, actually, about how pathetic I was. Isn't that funny? The idiot with the rod standing there. But my boss made us listen to Rush Limbaugh every day. Dr. Laura, too. I swear, I don't know how I made it out of there alive. But anyway, the only thing I really remember about the Rush Limbaugh show, other than thinking, man, you'd have to already be really rich to like this guy. But anyway, the only thing that I really even remember about that show, I listened to it for, I guess, 2 summers straight, is that I remember thinking how great it must be to show up at your radio show every morning and you got 10 young people doing what you say. Hey, you, Google everything in the world that's happened in Egypt for the last week. You know, this would be my version of it. Hey, you, write me up these headlines like Amy Goodman style to read as the intro to the show. Hey, you, what's the name of that guy who, you know, what's his name? My favorite economist was talking about who did the thing. Go and research that for me. And he would do that live during the show, right? I mean, he would say, go look up golf scores or go justify white supremacy or, you know, whatever his shtick was. But I'm just saying that's how I would have used him. That's how I would use him. I'm still to this day so jealous of that. I just think this show could be great if, you know, I had $1 million to produce it with, some incredible thing. If I had a real radio station with even, you know, one helper, I don't know. But anyway, I don't have any of that, and I don't really need any of that. That's just being silly. I don't need nothing, man. The wife and I, we got a very cheap little place. My truck is 16, 17 years old, runs just fine. It's a Nissan. So it'll be good for another 100,000 miles or two or three or whatever. I'm not worried about that. All I need is a little bit of peanut butter so I don't die. And the electric bill so I can do the show. And, you know, earlier this week, I was driving down the street and I was trying to listen to the news. And I heard just these ridiculous pitches on NPR for donating to the show. And I guess you have to be shameless to get the job done, and that's why I don't get the job done. But they're sitting there talking about, you know, it's an issue of trust. And we trust our listeners. And they all talk in that fake half whisper. It's an issue of trust between us and our listeners that you will help us to continue to provide the that you come to rely on. So, you know what? If you like the show and you can help support the show, please do, okay? I cannot I cannot. I know what I need to do is work harder at selling ads to people, charging them money to do the ads on the show, and then just do it that way and no donations at all, because I hate asking for donations at all. I sure as hell am not going to sit here and patronize you. But I am going to tell you that the cost of living is going up. I can report that to you. And the cost of doing this show is not free, although it is cheap. I do work very cheap. I live very cheap. I could just use a little bit of help. And so, especially if you're a libertarian and you're familiar with marginal utility and the diamond water problem and all that, and you have a big pile of money where any small portion of that pile is actually, you know, after third or fourth pile in line, doesn't mean that much to you anymore, then, you know, go ahead and kick down. ScottHorton.org/donate. I'm sorry to have to do that, but I have to do that. That's how the show exists. If I don't do that, there's no show. Simple as that. So, it sucks, but it is what it is. Now, I guess I don't have time. Yeah, I do. What the hell? Listen to this, man.
In the price.
What did we get out of Iraq, though? I mean, we're, as Americans, we're all in it together. Mm-hmm. We're all in it together. It's easy to finger point. They finger pointed you and Bush. And I don't want to do that. But we spent $1 trillion on this with a lot of pain and suffering on the American military. What did we get out of it?
Well,
beside
and Dick Cheney.
Saddam being out of there.
Yeah.
What?
But remember what we were faced with in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. We had a lot of evidence to indicate that, in fact, Al-Qaeda was trying to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction. We had in Saddam Hussein a guy who had produced and used weapons of mass destruction.
Okay, I don't blame you,
of course,
Vice President Cheney or President Bush, for doing what you did. I mean, I'm not back Monday morning quarterbacking. But what right now? What do we get out of Iraq for all that blood and treasure? What do we get out of it?
What we gained, and my concern was then, and it remains today, is that the biggest threat we face is the possibility of terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda equipped with weapons of mass destruction, with nukes, bugs, or gas. That was the threat after 9/11. And when we took down Saddam Hussein, we eliminated Iraq as
back.
A potential source of that.
Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia is back.
That's right. But they wouldn't be if they'd followed our policies that we laid out for them when we left.
Okay.
But also, let me finish.
Sure.
In terms of what we got out of it, we took down Saddam as a major source. 5 days after we got Saddam, Muammar Gaddafi announced he was going to surrender his nuclear materials, and he had centrifuges, he had a weapons design, he had the uranium feedstock, and after we took care of that, we took down AQ Khan, who was his major supplier, the father of the Pakistan program. It was run into black market operation. We've put him out of business. We got rid of three major sources of potential proliferation of nuclear weapons.
All right.
Man, can you believe that? All right, now listen. I got to debunk fast as I possibly can. First of all, in another part of that, Cheney said that Obama thinks that they overreacted to 9/11, as though there could be any overreaction to 9/11. But never mind Obama. The criticism, of course, is that they let Osama bin Laden escape. It's not that they overreacted. We'd all been happy if they blew up Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri 100 times. Cut their throats, cut their heads off, play soccer with them. We don't care what you do to them, the responsible. The problem was going to Iraq and killing hundreds and 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 hundreds of thousands of people who had nothing to do with it. Turning the entire region into a boiling cauldron of death and pain. Overreacted. God. And then, so Cheney's a liar, right? Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction. You can read at foxnews.com. They didn't have any weapons of mass destruction after 1991. Oh, Saddam lied about his mustard gas, all right, for about 3 months after the end of the war. And the UN busted him, and then they destroyed it all. And it never existed after that. So, yeah, that sure is a great accomplishment of the war, keeping Al-Qaeda down. And then he says it was Obama's decision to leave. Bush signed the Status of Forces Agreement in 2008 when the Shiite majority we helped install in power kicked our ass right out of there. Thanks for everything. Now beat it, they said. Iran's allies, not ours. What did we get out of it? We sure as hell didn't get a loyal sock puppet ally in the Middle East, did we? No. Right now, America's fighting on the side of Al-Qaeda in Syria, and our no-good Nick friends, the Shiite Iraqis that we put in power there, are on the side of Iran and on the side of the Shiite government of Syria against Al-Qaeda. Ha! How unreliable of them. Can you believe the nerve? And another thing, Gaddafi only ever bought a bunch of crap from AQ Khan's garage sale so that he could give it up. And everybody knows that. And he never even had a weapons program whatsoever. And he'd been begging to come back in from the cold since 1996. You damned liar. You read about it in the New York Times magazine where Senator Gary Hart said, yeah, Gaddafi's guys came to me on their knees begging in 1996. We'll do anything. Please bring us back in from the cold, said Gaddafi's dictatorship in Libya. No mention of the fact that he then came out in approval of Obama's war against Gaddafi after Dick Cheney made the deal with him. And then AQ Khan, of course, the CIA knew that AQ Khan stole Yurenko centrifuge blueprints from the very, very beginning and let him get away. And they knew that he had his black market operation all over the world the whole time all along. You could read in Jane's Defense Weekly or Monthly or whatever back in 2002 about how AQ Khan had a nuclear centrifuge stall at the weapons fair, at the International Weapons Bazaar, out there in the public in front of everybody. Oh, what a great accomplishment that the CIA finally shut down their black market nuclear weapons front that they were helping to run. Oh, I'm so impressed. And then, oh yeah, again, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, shrug. Whatever. I guess that's Obama's fault because I said stay forever and then that wouldn't be a problem. Yeah, right. It never was a problem before the war at all. It became a war. You know what? Zarqawi, the mad suicide bomber brigade leader, he didn't even declare loyalty to bin Laden and Zawahiri until the end of 2004. Like December 31st, 2004, when the war was almost two full years old. He then declared that his terrorist group was loyal to the goals of bin Laden. Oh, there's not a punishment severe enough for what ought to happen to Dick Cheney. And never even mind for the deaths, for the lies. Has there ever been such a liar in the history of the world as this guy? Boy, I'm way over time, and I gotta get my guest on here. First of all, here's George W. Bush talking about Osama bin Laden right here. This is only 4 months after September 11. This is in the beginning of 2002, February of 2002.
You know, again, I don't know where he is. I repeat what I said. I truly am not that concerned about him.
All right, we'll be right back with Francis Nesbitt about Somalia right after this. Go, you goddamn thing, I said. All right, then. We'll be right back. Bad news first. I can't get a hold of this guy. He's in Kenya right now. But the good news is, I don't have any more guests lined up for today. So as soon as I hear back from him, we'll have another chance to iron this out. And it'll be great. I'm just getting a busy signal is the problem, so I don't know what's wrong. Could be I'm doing it wrong. I don't know if I've ever called Kenya. Yeah, I have called Kenya a couple of times, but I'm not very familiar. And, you know, it's all in one big list of numbers there. It's not broken up by the dashes the way I'm used to. All them weird old world phone numbers the way they are. Anyway, thanks to Ad-Rock and the boys for filling in for me there. That's okay, too, because I still got plenty to talk about. But I just think it's amazing that Dick Cheney would come out and say that what America gained from the Iraq War, he has no other thing that he can say. He can't say, yeah, we really helped limit the influence of Iran in the region. Oops. He can't say, yeah, we made sure that there would never be such a thing as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Nope, couldn't say that. Yeah, we got a loyal ally in Baghdad helping us back Al-Qaeda in Syria right now. Nope, they're on the side of Iran and the Syrian government in that one. Oh, well, I got a bunch of oil for, well, I guess there's... The Exxon made a deal with the Kurds, but pretty much the rest of the oil resources are being developed by French and Russian and Chinese companies. Uh-huh, just like in the production. So what did America get out of it? Not a damn thing. Not a damn thing. And, you know, it's too bad that Bill O'Reilly is the one doing the asking there, because he could sort of come back and go, well, but I thought we were, like, going to get a friendly country out of this. No? Wasn't that one of the benchmarks? Hey, how about the fact that there's a horrifying civil war raging to this day? What about the mass horror unfolding in Iraq right now? Here's war-weary Iraqis scared to leave homes as violence reaches levels not seen since 2008. You know, when the surge stopped. The bloodiest year since 08 has left many Iraqis terrified of leaving their homes for fear of being killed by bombs or kidnapped. Of course, Nouri al-Maliki is a nightmare for the people of Iraq, for all of them, too. You know, it's not like, oh, well, yeah, all the Shiite Arabs are benefiting at the expense of the Sunnis or something like that. I don't think anybody's benefiting but Maliki himself. And to this day, he refuses to appoint ministers to all the top positions so that they all are just answerable to him. And now then again, Patrick Cobrin says that there will be another election and he will not be able to cancel it. Maliki cannot make himself the strongman dictator. He's too reliant on others for his power. And any attempt of, you know, of Maliki's to get away with that would be canceled by the likes of Muqtada al-Sadr and others in the Shiite faction, so he's not quite Saddam Hussein. He could possibly, I guess, be replaced at some point by some other force from within the United Iraqi Alliance, but other than that, it doesn't look like they're ever going to include the Sunnis in the government at all. And that's why the war has started back up again. Right, all the promises of the surge that we're going to create the security space for a political solution to be reached. That never happened. That's why they stopped talking about the benchmarks, because they failed every single one of them. Only in America do we celebrate, you know, if it wasn't for the sex scandal, and he'll get over that soon enough. But only in America would we celebrate a general who lost two wars like David Petraeus as some kind of heroic leader. And pay him $200,000 to give a leadership speech or whatever kind of thing. It's just like, God, I think it might have been Jonathan Schwartz blog about how, maybe not, I think it was, about how at the Olympics in China a few years back, how the Chinese won. They got more golds than anybody. But all the American media agreed, and this might have been, I forgot what year it was. Was it 08 or something? All the American media agreed that the Americans won because they got the most medals. if you count all the silvers and bronzes too. Like, really? Is that where the demand is in American media now, that we're all kindergartners? And in fact, you know, when I was in kindergarten, my team always lost, whether it was soccer or t-ball or whatever it was. So what? Right? Nowadays, little kids, they can't ever lose. And nowadays, never mind little kids, Americans, they can never lose. They can never be told, aw, good game, better luck next time. You killed hundreds and 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 hundreds of thousands of people for nothing. Good game, good game. Go home. Practice for next time. Nope. We got to pretend, hey, the surge worked. You know how I know it worked? Because somebody said that 7,000 times. I memorized it. It's got to be true. Well, no, the Sunnis have no political power inside the government whatsoever, and any part of the Constitution that said, well, it wasn't exactly, you know, like Lebanon this way, but it was sort of kind of set up where a Sunni will be the vice president. A former Ba'athist or somebody who knew one or something will be the vice president. Nope, they chased him out of town. They accused him of leading a death squad, which is probably true, but they put out a warrant for his arrest, chased him down to Qatar, where he's in exile now, and the Shiite majority in their parliament there is, seemingly in control. And I guess the Sunni Arabs in Iraq feel, one, like their back's against the wall, they have no choice, but then, two, they have this renewed confidence since their war has now joined up with the Syrian war on the other side of that fake 1920 border there. And they're both fighting like enemies. Of course, America is on opposite sides in the two different wars, but the Sunni Arab insurgents is basically the same insurgency, right? That's why they call it the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or the Sham, which is, I guess, the Arabic term for the Levant, that region of the Eastern Mediterranean there, Israel, Lebanon, Syria. And so, anyway, and I guess Jordan, too, I don't know. I'm not exactly certain what counts as the Levant or doesn't. It's a region, not a state. But anyway. But what a disaster, man. Yeah, please read this article. It's at worldnews.nbcnews.com. War-weary Iraqis. This is in case you're hearing this decades later and you're a historian and you found the treasure trove of the best information of all the early 21st century here in these files. It's the end of October, almost, 2013 now, 10.5 years out from the start of the war. War-weary Iraqis scared to leave homes as violence reaches levels not seen since 2008. And what exactly is the role being played by the State Department and the CIA right now in this? And even the military, to some limited degree, special operations guys or whatever degree they are, I don't know. There were reports that the CIA was going to be helping Maliki basically chase the jihadists into Syria where they could be more useful for our goals. Oh, yeah, no. The Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq, they're still the bad guys in Iraq, but they're the good guys in Syria. Funny enough. But what a disaster, man. And, you know, the limited talking points that Cheney's got to resort to on the benefits of the Iraq war. Oh, it was the invasion of Iraq that scared Gaddafi into giving up his advanced nuclear weapons program, huh? How about no part of that is true? Give me a freaking break. Who's still buying that? Oh, yeah, I guess the warehouses full of sarin and VX and mustard gas and all that must have been shipped off to Syria right now. Oh, except for the weapons inspectors are cataloging every bit of Syrian chemical weapons there, and none of that is Saddam stuff. Saddam stuff all ceased to exist in 1991. All those lies were lies. Lies. Oh, very bloody, filthy, disgusting lies. Dick Cheney. I can't believe this guy's on the loose. He's out there walking the streets, right? Like George Carlin would say, you believe this guy, the bad guy, the criminal, he's out there walking the streets right now. I forgot the rest of the bit. Sorry. I was going to plagiarize it, but then I plumb forgot. You know what? I guess I have to check and see if that's on YouTube, right? Just in case. I shouldn't leave out. Out. Don't leave out. Walking. Google is suggesting it, so I ain't the first one. Googled this one. Expressions part one. Out walking the streets. A guy gets parole. You say no. Instead of being in prison, this guy's out walking the streets. How do we know? Is that it? Is that all it was? How do we know he's out walking the streets? Oh, no. He goes on. All right. How do we know? Maybe the guy's home banging the babysitter. Not everyone who gets a parole is out walking the streets. A lot of times, they'll steal a car. Thank God he stole a car. At least he's not out walking the streets. You get a like from me, Mr. George Carlin quoter person. Out walking the streets. Dick Cheney's out walking the streets. By the way, this is stupid politics, but I saw where Dick Cheney is calling his daughter's opponent, the sitting senator, Inzi, from Wyoming. Cheney's calling him a damn liar for saying, oh, he didn't say damn, that's just me, but calling him a liar for saying that they're fishing buddies. Well, I think some intrepid reporter ought to get to the bottom of that one for us. What is the real truth? Have these two men ever fished together before or not? Early indications are that Dick Cheney's daughter, Liz, who is horrifying, think Hillary Clinton, only meaner. Meaner than Hillary Clinton, just like her in every other way. But meaner. Apparently, she's not doing well whatsoever. So far, my prediction that Enzi is going to go ahead and step down because he wants to live, to spend more time with his family, quote unquote. That so far has not come true. So he must be one tough guy because they must have threatened him by now, right? Are you kidding me? Remember that New York Times piece where the New York Times reporter was hanging around at the local Republican Party thing there in Wyoming? And local blue-haired Republican lady was saying, oh, that Liz Cheney, you know, we really like Mike Enzi and she should wait her turn and we're not so sure. And you say you write for the newspaper? Hey, that is off the record. I didn't say nothing and you don't know nothing about me. And I think Dick Cheney and his beautiful daughter Liz are just great. Man, they're terrified of that guy. I was like, what? I was just accidentally insulting Tony Soprano? Oh, God. Please don't tell him. It was an accident. I swear to God, I had no idea that you were going to repeat that. Anyway, fun stuff. Occasionally fun stuff in the New York Times. Liz Cheney, I'd very much like to see her fail to become a senator. I guess if I was a little bit more like George Carlin, that is, detached, I would just encourage it, right? Hey, if you're going to have a U.S. Senate, you might as well have Liz Cheney up there running the entire right half of it. Boy, wouldn't that be fun to watch Rand Paul down on one knee, bending to her will each and every day of the rest of his life, too. Hey, whatever you say, Liz. I mean, seriously, in that contest of wills, I wouldn't put any man up against Liz Cheney, dude. I don't mean to be all sexist or whatever, but she's some kind of a caricature of a dragon lady ball buster horror show, dude. She is frightening in every way, you know? Can you imagine if she was ever the president one day, how many human beings would lose their lives violently? Be like looking at one of those declassified studies of casualties from a full-scale nuclear war between America and the Soviet Union. Well, this is how many hundreds of millions of people we would expect to die in the first few weeks, you know, before the real effects start kicking in. Anyway, by the way, for those of you who think that there's got to be some alternative to the terror war, the way it's being carried out, well, you think it should be carried out somehow, I might give you that if it was still 2001 and they hadn't done anything wrong yet. I think we've learned if you give them a 16th of an inch, they will take 10,000 miles. You just cannot give your government permission to exist at all or to carry out a single mission on your behalf, because they will take your permission and then they will do whatever they want with it. You know, like turn the Tigris red with blood. So you just can't ask them to do any damn thing at all. But if this was a world where there was such a thing as the Constitution and actually had the force of law at all, then the Congress would have taken up Ron Paul on his proposal around this time, 10 years ago, or it would have been 12 years ago, to issue letters of marque and reprisal. And I saw Alan Grayson bring that up today and refused to give Ron Paul credit for trying to make it this way right after the September 11th attack. He says, listen, they weren't perfect, but the founders of the American government, they did anticipate that the nation state would have enemies smaller than other nation states, like, for example, the pirates. And so Congress has the authority under the Constitution, assuming you accept that anyone had the authority to create the Constitution in the first place, which is, of course, completely laughable. But anyway, assuming that for the sake of argument, it's not a perfect world, what are you going to do? If you were to have a constitutional government, then letters of marque and reprisal are perfect for a fight like Al-Qaeda, if, again, this was back in the fall of 01. Because what you do is you would just say, this group, this Al-Qaeda group, the base, there's a few hundred of them, kill them. You have the right to kill them, delegated by the U.S. Congress, to hunt them down in their failed state of Afghanistan and to take their lives. You're not allowed to kill any innocent people, but you sure as hell are allowed to kill these guys. Or, you know, you could do a wanted dead or alive thing, bring them back for trial, and then give them a fair trial. As Jacob Hornberger's been pointing out every single day since then, hey, terrorism is a crime. It's not an act of war. Even a real big successful attack is still just a crime. In fact, of course, it makes PR sense to treat these people like they're the lowest scum of the earth rather than making them out to be the leaders of the Soviet Union. Now, of course, for the Republicans and the Democrats, they, for their own reasons, as Osama bin Laden was counting on, they could have been counted on. They were reliable in taking 9/11 as the excuse to get away with any blue bloody murder they could possibly think of. And so they needed to pretend, they needed to let bin Laden go, and they needed to pretend that there was this massive Islamo-fascist caliphate that existed somewhere on the map. There must have been a conversation in the National Security Council somewhere, right, where someone joked that, don't worry, the American people will believe this because we don't teach them geography in government school anymore. They have no idea how many continents there are or you know, where on earth this Islamo-fascist caliphate might be. They can imagine it because they can't imagine that there's any other mass taking up that same space anywhere. They just don't know. So we'll just tell them there's an Islamo-fascist caliphate roughly the size of the USSR and that it's headed this way. For some reason, they don't even have an Air Force or a Navy or anything like that. They had to hijack our planes to attack us. But anyway, they're coming. Got to stop them. And so, of course, that was playing right into the enemy's hands. The smart thing to do would have been what Ron Paul said, a letter of marque, a death warrant for bin Laden, Zawahiri, and their 200 closest friends, and then the entire terror war, and they could have just sent the special forces to accomplish that, or any, you know, private Eric Prince types if they wanted to do it, Blackwater style, just hire mercs. If you kill any innocent people, we'll put you in prison. You're not allowed to kill innocent people. Murder's murder. You are allowed to kill Zawahiri, and in fact, why not make a contest out of it, like Gimli and Legolas in the Lord of the Rings flick. See, you know, how many pieces you can chop him into. You know, whatever, that's fine. But just him, not innocent people who happen to be near him. Guilty people who happen to be near him, that's okay too. And then the whole thing would have been over by Christmas 2001. People would be like, oh yeah, the war on terror. That was a brutal couple of months, man. Thank goodness that's over. And then, yeah, that was great the way George Bush then insisted that Ariel Sharon pull all the settlements out of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and create a Palestinian state there. And or at least cut off all funding for them forever. For the Israelis. Got all the troops out of Saudi Arabia and made friends with Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollah Khamenei both. Brilliant statesmanship there. Thank goodness they got rid of Bill Clinton and Al Gore and the children and brought in the real adults to take care of business, man. Boy, did they take care of business. What a golden era that was. From, you know, January 1st, 2002 on. It was, what a happy new year, man. The shortest war in American history. God, it was something else. Yeah, you're right, Alan Grayson. That is how you should have done it back then. I don't agree that that's how you should do it now. You know how you should do it now? Abolish all of Washington, D.C. That's it. Just deny them all power. You're not the government anymore, any of you. Oh, you can parade around your little statues all day, but your words and your papers ain't law no more. And your orders ain't orders, and your policies ain't nothing but opinions in the air. You're done. You're dissolved. You're abolished. We're free. You're fired. That's how to protect America from terrorism best right there. That's an actual scientific fact, by the way. It's not just my wonderful opinion, which it also happens to be. But, yeah, you know, this is one consequence of the American people not taking the slightest interest, you know. Oh, yeah, we the people, this, that. Oh, the government is us. They can't oppress us. It's impossible for the government that's locking me in shackles right now to be doing so because I am the government, the American people all sing. We the people. No. But the problem is believing all that without any of the specifics or the details leads you to overlook things like the letter of mark and reprisal. Ron Paul was a voice alone on the House Foreign Affairs Committee in 2001, trying to get a letter of mark and reprisal. And he ended up trying to introduce a declaration of war against Iraq, which he himself voted against, and he made a statement at the time, which this used to be on YouTube. I don't think I could find it that quickly to do it live here on the show for you, but there was a clip of him anyway on YouTube, and you can find it of him on the House Foreign Affairs Committee saying, I'm against this war, I'm against any of this, but it is a war, it is an invasion, and the Congress must take responsibility for this, rather than authorizing the president to decide. They pretend that it's an authorization of war, but what it really is it's them sloughing off their constitutional responsibility onto the president. And then you get to hear people like Hillary Clinton, not just her, but a lot of them too, Joe Biden, our current vice president too, and they will say, we didn't vote for war in Iraq. We voted to give the president the authority for war because we thought that with that extra tough authority behind him, then Saddam Hussein would really, you know, do what he was told and whatever. But we never wanted George Bush to have a war. We merely authorized him to have one. Not our fault, his fault. In fact, that's how Obama got the nomination from Hillary. It was because she tried to hide behind those weasel words and people actually weren't buying it. But anyway, that's the thing of it. And Ron Paul said, well, declare war then. It's your responsibility to declare war, Republican majority who insists on this. And of course they didn't because they're cowards. And they did not live up to their responsibility to do so. Not that they should have. They should have voted no, just like Ron Paul who introduced it. He was just calling them out. And you could look this up. I don't know if you can find the video anymore, but you can certainly find the quote from Alan Hyde, who you might remember him from being the impeachment manager against Bill Clinton in 1998 in the House of Representatives. Is it Alan Hyde? Henry Hyde. Who's Alan Hyde? That's someone else. Oh, Alan Hyde, I think, is the guy that did the Opinion Business Research study about civilian casualties in Iraq. I'm sorry, Alan, not you. Henry Hyde, the Jabba the Hutt looking, he looked just like Webb Hubble. Only a Republican. Anyway, he said, no, that part of the Constitution is an anachronism. We don't do that anymore. That's outdated. Now we do authorizations. We let the president decide to have a war, Dr. Paul. So you're a joke. Ha ha ha, he said. All right, anyway, I'm going to try to get Francis Nesbitt about Somalia here in a sec. He wrote this great thing for FPIF. I told you about it yesterday.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, well, I guess I take responsibility. Must be my fault. I'm too stupid to call Kenya right. All I keep getting is a busy signal, and it can't be that he just left the phone off the hook, right? And it can't be that he just decided to take another call for an hour and a half without leaving me an email. So it's got to be me. Although, you know, I have had a phone just slightly off the hook before and didn't know. It's been a long time since that happened, but I guess that's within the realm of possibility, right? I don't know. What the hell? I sent him an email. Anyway, I don't care. I'm going to interview him later. It'll be fine. You think I can't talk for 2 hours? You ain't never met me before. And I'm sorry. I'm really sorry that I can't figure out how to reach this guy, because I really wanted you guys to hear what he has to say. I'm going to stumble around while I'm trying to figure out how to beg you to go and read his article at fpif.org. That's John Pfeffer and the guys at Foreign Policy in Focus. And his name is Francis Nesbitt. And he's got this incredible piece about al-Shabaab's savage coming of age. And, well, look, if you're like me, you care a lot about American policy in East Africa. It's the wave of the future, I'm afraid to say. Is it the way of the future or the wave of the future? I guess people say it both ways, but it really should just be the way of the future, right? Isn't that the original? Maybe there's an etymological expert out there somewhere for me. Anyway, this is where the empire kills people all day, every day for fun. And it's a huge, horrifying scandal. And Francis Nesbitt has written this incredibly, God dang it, I can't talk right today. Insightful piece about who's who in al-Shabaab, what they want, the foreign governments at war in Somalia, how the war has spread to Nairobi, Kenya, what the terrorists were trying to get out of it, what they've gotten out of it so far, what it all means. It's great. It's great. So I apologize that I'm not able to get it worked out. But anyway, how about I'll have him on tomorrow for you. And, you know, maybe later in the show. We still got an hour to go here, so maybe I'll hear back from him and he'll say, oh, you know what? The number I gave you should have had one more one in it. That happens. Otherwise, we'll see if we can get him on the show for you tomorrow. I'm happy to go ahead and continue to recommend my article at fff.org. I think it's, I admit, it's not the most well-written, and I want to strangle whoever's the copy editor. But anyway, at fff.org, there is what I believe is, well, certainly my best effort. I believe it is the single best short summary of why everything is horrible in Somalia. It's all America's fault. And what it is about American policy since the turn of the century that's made it as horrible as it is. And it's all there for you at fff.org. It's called U.S. Government Responsible for Somalia's Misery. And I think it makes pretty good background. It's not very detailed, excellent, real expert stuff like this. I mean, Francis Nesbitt, he's in Kenya right now. I think he's from there. Anyway, he knows what the hell he's talking about. I know the general issue, right? I'm the second-hand purveyor of knowledge here. But that also gives me an advantage, too, because I've talked with Leslie Lefkow, and I've talked with Jeremy Scahill, and I've talked with Francis Nesbitt, and I've talked with Thomas Mountain, and I've talked with other experts on Somalia, Ken Menkhaus, and so I've learned a lot. And then I get to try my best, anyway, to sort of synthesize it for you. I haven't really interviewed the libertarians that did their studies about pre-American intervention, very, very early 21st century Somalia, under their sort of de facto anarcho-capitalist system, which was working wonderfully there before America ruined it. I should interview those guys, too. But anyway, the biggest story is the famine. Let it never go unsaid about the famine. The weather in 2010 and 11, especially, but I guess 09 too, but especially in 10 and 11, really, really was horrible. And they were going to have some kind of massive disruption one way or the other. But all this took place in the shadow of America's war. And so the people of Somalia were hit the hardest. And they just laid down and died. 250,000 of them. And it's America's fault. The American politicians, George W. Bush and everyone, and Obama too, and everyone who's gone along with them on their Somalia policy, they're responsible. Because it's not that nobody could grow any crops, it's that nobody could distribute anything to anyone. Their entire market system was completely smashed. People were just starving in refugee camps. And then, and here's the thing I don't understand enough about, and I really need to do the work. But Thomas Mountain, he gets so pissed off about Tony Lake. Remember Bill Clinton tried to make Tony Lake the head of the CIA, and they stopped him because of what a commie rat he was? I forget exactly. I think the problem with him was that he was a commie rat, but I don't remember exactly the detail of what prevented him from moving up from National Security Advisor to Director of Central Intelligence back in the Clinton years. Would have been 95 or something like that. But, you know, I do remember that Bill Clinton blamed Tony Lake for the disaster of Black Hawk Down. I don't know. In fact, I'll give you the exact quote. I'll tell you exactly what happened. I saw it on Frontline. The father of a dead American Ranger met Bill Clinton at some handshaky thing and said, "Hey, my son died there in Somalia, so I want to ask you a question." And Bill Clinton said, "Yes, okay, go ahead. You know, what am I going to do?" And he said, "So you were going over there to negotiate. You're trying to negotiate with Adid, the warlord, and try to work out some kind of deal with this guy, right?" And Bill Clinton said, "Yeah, that's right." And he goes, "Yeah, well then, so why did you send my son to go and try to kill him and capture him, or kill him or capture him that same day that you're trying to work out a deal with him? That doesn't make much sense. So which is it? Which had the priority, neither or both or what?" And then this is the father explaining the story to Frontline. He said, "Bill Clinton looked at me with the most blank expression I've ever seen on a man's face. And he just said nothing for a while. And then finally he sputtered, 'Well, I asked Tony Lake the same question. What do I know? I'm just the president. I'm not the one in charge here. The buck stops with my national security advisor.' God, that guy's the scum of the earth. Can you imagine being told that by the President of the United States about how he got your son killed?" Anyway, Tony Lake was in charge of distributing the food aid. And I don't know all the details, but Thomas Mountain says, "Oh, yeah, it was all his fault because he didn't give a damn about getting his job done. You know, he made sure it was his job, no one else's." and 250,000 Somalis starved. And yeah, come on. You already know in your heart, don't you? Somewhere in there, back in the back of your brain, you're already thinking, well, which Somalis, Scott? According to the U.S. and British governments and their U.N. sock puppet agency, 260 million of them died. I mean, 260,000 of them died, 250,000. And half of them were children, under 5 years old. Little bitty children, starving to death. Because George Bush and Barack Obama decided to set their whole country on fire for fun because they're monsters. You know, and all this crap about, oh, poor Tom Hanks and the pirates. And they get to sit there and tell a whole story about Somali pirates without explaining why these guys are all so skinny. That doesn't seem fair to me, you know? You get to destroy somebody's society, and then you get to pretend like the absolute lowest of their dregs, or the problem, or the cause of what's wrong over there somewhere. Those savages hijacking ships. Welcome to civilization, people, right? With no mention about how everything bad that has happened to them is because of George Bush and Barack Obama and their terror war. To be more specific, their Ethiopian, Kenyan, Ugandan, and Burundian-backed invasions and mass murder sprees. An attempt to set up a big fake government in Mogadishu since Christmas 2006. There only is Al-Shabaab as a reaction to America's war there. It's as simple as that. And you know what? There's no such thing as the government. Melis Zenawi. I mean, he's dead now, but anyway. Melis in Ethiopia and all of these countries, Kenya, Burundi, Uganda, they don't even exist, okay? They're just fronts for the American empire. That's all they are. Little tiny satellite states of the 9-zillion-ton gorilla. The most powerful empire in the history of mankind that says, Uganda, invade Somalia because I said so. And they say, jump how high? Ethiopia, invade. Done. Kenya, invade. We talked a little bit about the consequences of that. Kenya's great victory in Kismayo. We're going to talk with this author one way or the other eventually with Francis Nesbitt about this. Kenya's great victory in dislodging Al-Shabaab from Kismayo last year, all that did was deprive them of money. So they had to come up with a new sales pitch for fundraising, which is, hey, Saudis, bankroll us and we'll declare loyalty to Zawahiri and the international jihad. That's their new PR stunt, is to attack outside their borders, you know, like the mall in Nairobi, Kenya. It's the saddest thing. And you know what? I don't know. It gets to my very basic fairness. We're like, come on, man. You can't be the USA and pick on Somalia. Remember that clip of Richard Pryor I played for you about 3 years ago? You guys have all been listening to every show ever since then, right? It was 5 years ago. I don't know. There's a great Richard Pryor from would have been 1985. I don't know. But anyway, he stops in the middle of his comedy routine. He's wearing a red jacket, although I think he is in a lot of them. He's wearing a red suit. And he just stops in the middle of his comedy routine. And he goes, you know, it's funny to me. You know what I don't understand? Ronald Reagan bombing Libya. I mean, we're the USA, right? In fact, he might start out with that. Everybody's like, yeah, USA, big and strong and tough and powerful. What are we doing picking on a tiny little country like Libya? Isn't that a piece of crap little country? I thought we fight big bad guys like the Nazis and the Soviet Union. We stared down the big Russian bear. Now we're bombing a little country. And now Richard Pryor, he's a comedian, and he knows he's a comedian. And so he doesn't say, rah, 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 Malcolm X speech. He just says, I don't understand. it doesn't seem right to me. Does that seem right to you guys? And the whole audience is like, yeah, what's up with that, Richard Pryor? You're right, dude. And then he goes on. That's it. No punchline. He just goes back to his thing again. I'll tell you the trouble about dating women, man. They're a pain in the ass or whatever it is, you know. But that's the way I feel about this Somalia thing. Like, dude, are you kidding me? What are you doing? You're killing the Somalis? You know, at least Iraq takes up a little bit of landmass or something. I don't know. If you use your imagination, it could be scary. But Somalia, well, that's just the poorest bastards in the world all collected in one place right there. You know, that's the town of Bedrock, man. That's like bombing Afghanistan. So maybe how we got so desensitized to this. Well, we'll just kill 150,000 children, whatever, you know. 125,000 children under 5 years old. Well, you know, we feel the price is worth it. We have this thing called a policy, and we like it. In fact, I should make more parallels to foreign countries. I think it's always easier if you make the parallel to a foreign country. We all know how World War I, and particularly the way the British and the French rubbed it in and took too much advantage of their victory in World War I, thanks to Woodrow Wilson and his intervention on their behalf. But part of that, and how that helped lead to World War II and the rise of the Nazis, the people of Germany's willingness to tolerate the rise of the communists and the Nazis, for that matter, in their society, in the face of all that desperation. Well, as we learned from Andrew Coburn on the show just a few months back, the great journalist Andrew Coburn, author of Rumsfeld, he wrote this incredible thing for Harper's about sanctions, the perfect instrument. And that name comes from the British and their blockade of the Germans after World War I, during and after. And as you may know, they kept it, I forget now for how long, at least a year, I believe a couple of years after the end of the war. They just kept starving the Germans anyway. I mean, their only access to the shore is the North Shore there. And the Brits had complete mastery of the sea and just completely blockaded them. And Andrew Coburn goes through and he quotes the administrators of the policy about how they had just gotten the bureaucracy perfected. Right at the end of the war. It was the perfect instrument. They had all of their different little departments, right? Like picture the movie Brazil, where dude works in a little office there or whatever. They finally had everything humming along just exactly how they wanted it. How to prevent the Germans from being able to import food from anywhere. And so they starved. And the whole thing of it was the bureaucratic inertia. And all of the pressure from the actual organization itself up through the chain of command to the British government that we've just got to keep this damn blockade just because we're so good at blockading now. You know, we have all the ships in place. We have all the communications gear. We have all our little departments and agencies and administrators of it. And we just want to keep it. It's just how we operate. And we just can't stop, you know. A little bit out of control. Anyway. All right. Oh, hell, I got to play this for you, don't I? Well, it's about to kick in. Here, let me say one more time about the fund drive. I'm terrible at raising money, so you've got to help me make up for that by just being real good at helping me raise money, okay? I don't need much. I just need everything that you can spare. That's all. ScottHorton.org/donate. Any donation more than $100, and I'll send you a commodity disc in the mail as your free gift. And be thankful that I don't carry on like NPR about it. I don't think that would work anyway.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, y'all. We all want to sit around listening to Turbo Negro all afternoon, but we can do that after the show. Yeah, you could do the show during the show if you want. Just please don't turn the show off. Yeah. That's what you do, man. You get your iPod playing me and your iPhone playing Turbo Negro, and then you switch ears with your buds. I don't know. Whatever. Anyway, it's the show. I'm going to try again in just a few minutes at the bottom of the hour break to get Francis Nesbitt on to talk about his great Somali piece. Sorry that hadn't worked out for you. I was really looking forward to that. And I'm also sorry that all my awesome new bumper stickers that I sent to libertystickers.com don't seem to be posted in the recently added section yet. God dang it, Bobby. I sent in a few, about, I don't know, 6 or something. They're not necessarily all that good. I don't know. You might like them. That's libertystickers.com. Eventually, libertystickers.com. Eventually, they will sell Scott stickers that he just made up and sent in for you. Okay. Okay, I got to talk about the Obamacare thing for just a second. First of all, the reason for the crash, apparently, is because they realized at the last second that if you could see the prices before filling out all of your stuff so that they know how much of a welfare kickback you get, that you would flip out because it's all about the welfare kickback. Because the whole scheme here is to raise everyone's prices to the point where they can't afford it so that then everybody needs a government subsidy to pay for the thing. And while enslaving the young and healthy to pay more premiums, that way we will be able to lower the prices for the older and sicker. And yeah. Boy, well, I don't think anyone in the world who ain't, well, I don't know anybody who wants the exact status quo the way it is. I mean, obviously, the hospital companies, the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and all the fascist doctor associations and the rest of them, they want this kind of Nazism. You know, to put it mildly. It is. It's a fascist combine kind of a thing, you know? But everybody who's a victim of it, everybody who just wants to buy some health care so that they can not die or, you know, even get by in a little bit less diseaseness or injured state, we all want prices to go down. Nobody is happy with the insurance that they have. Everybody is desperately settling for the insurance they have if that's all that they can get with how messed up it has been all along. But, I don't know, man, to think that it's even acceptable for the policy to just outright, isn't it just outright stated this way? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to hike everyone's prices, and then we're going to give you a kickback subsidy to lower it back down again. A price hike and a welfare check. And we're going to make it mandatory for the young and healthy to buy insurance. Hey, you might need it. So we're going to force you to, or else you're a criminal, but you just have to pay a fine. So it's not like it matters if you break the law, because you just have to pay a fine, which is only like $100, so it's not really not that bad. But anyway, if you're into obeying the law, then you have to do it, young person who doesn't need it, in order to drive down the prices for people. Yeah, anyway, my solution is obvious. You just abolish the national government entirely. It's the same thing as how to win the terror war. It's the same way as how to get education to the kids. It's the same thing for every public issue that you think is an issue. How best to deal with our trade balance with China? Abolish the national government of the United States of America. It's as simple as that. Just embrace freedom. You, do I, never mind you, do I have any idea how many laws there are regarding healthcare and its delivery to people in America. No, but it's got to be in the billions of pages, billions of lines of regulatory code, right? On the state and federal level, especially. I mean, come on. It's been generations like this. You know, the only correction that Mises needed on the middle of the road leads to socialism is, in America, the middle of the road leads to socialism really slowly. And it sucks all the way there, and then once it's totally socialism, then it'll be even worse. But it takes a long time to get there, but this kind of fascist, complete clustered thing, what do you say when you're on the radio and you want to finish the word clustered? Cluck. This is the kind of thing that leads, you know, the John Stewarts of the world and all the Democrats to say, see, what we need is just Medicare for all. What we need is just the national government to pick up the bill for everything. Government has succeeded in driving prices so high and screwing everything up so bad. Hey, they're forcing everyone basically onto a welfare check through this thing anyway. Everybody who wasn't already on food stamps and unemployment trying to stay alive from their boom and bust cycle that they created for us. But if they're already doing it, you know what? Might as well just have Medicare for all, single payer for all, and then everybody just, you know, I don't know. Somehow the rich people still get all the best doctors, but they'll figure that part out. And that's where we're headed. Because this is going to be, look, the problems with this thing, forget the website, okay? The website, again, the problem was a major technical problem. At the last minute, they said, if Dave logs in and see that we've raised his price this high, before he sees how much we promised to give him as a rebate, as a government, socialist, kickback, welfare payment, rebate thing, he's going to freak, right? Never mind that he doesn't want it that way in the first place. You told him his rates were going to go down. But they realize if you see how much they've gone up, before the kickback, you're going to freak. So they said, we have to change the entire website. We have to make the website say, you know, you have to log in. You have to fill out your entire income. You have to, you know, give up your Fifth Amendment right, incriminate yourself in every way so that they can figure out how much welfare to give you before they'll even let you shop for your new higher price. And that's what caused the technical problem. Now, I'm no computer code genius, but I gotta figure that the computer code geniuses could figure this out. Just take it away from the people who couldn't get it done in time and give it to somebody else and make them do it right. They say now it's gonna take them a month. But eventually, sure, eventually they'll be able to have make it where everyone can sign up completely first and then go shopping or whatever without crashing the system. And then the real problems will begin. And already you're seeing just... well, it's a clustered cluck. People getting laid off, hours being cut so that, you know, all the hurdles are not crossed so that businesses can stay small enough and hours can stay less enough that they don't have to abide by the new requirements. Everybody getting, not everybody, but many people being kicked off of their old plans for something worse. And, you know, the only silver lining here is that it's the damned Democrats. Because, you know, if you think about, you know, Medicare Part D is as much of a boondoggle as that was. If you think about that as in terms of if that had been this bad of a disaster, they would have called it free market laissez-faire capitalism, right? They would have pretended like they did with the crash that George Bush was Ron Paul. And that all of a sudden, never mind that Herbert Hoover was Ron Paul, even though Herbert Hoover was much more like a George W. Bush. Compassionate, conservative, liberal, centrist, interventionist, progressivist type, certainly on financial matters, they would have pretended that it was freedom's fault. But in this case, this is the Democrats, right? This is, Obama said, Eric Garris reminded me that in the debates, like every debate, this is how Obama differentiated himself from Hillary Clinton. No mandate. The mandate? Why, that would be fascism. Oh, he didn't call it that. The mandate? No, we would never do that. Force people to buy a private company's product? No, that would be corruption and a conflict of interest. Who do you think's funding my campaign anyway? Insurance companies? That was how he beat Hillary Clinton. By, he wasn't there to vote yes for the Iraq war, which he probably would have if he'd had the chance. And she was. And he was against the mandate. And anyway, my prices have gone up. My health insurance has gone up. And it already is. I can't afford it. I'm sitting here begging you for money on the freaking show. And that's breaking the bank more than anything. It's the health insurance that's killing me. Ha, ha, ha. Hardy, har, har. And it's gone up. And in a few months, the policy I have will cease to exist and I'll have to get another one. And I'm sure it'll be unaffordable for anything. And you know what they'll do? They'll go, oh, no. You know what? Your premium is only like $500 a month now. Oh, yeah, but your yearly deductible is now $15,000. So why don't you go blow your own brains out? It's going to be like that. Maybe not 15. How about 5? How about 7? How about, I can't do that. Can you do that? Something, you actually have a real catastrophe, something that in a free market you might actually need health insurance for, right? Something severe instead of your, you know, regular office visit or whatever, which you ought to be able to afford on the free market. But, oh no, you actually have a real catastrophe. You come down with something life-threatening or a severe injury, and all of a sudden, oh yeah, sure, you're covered as soon as you're done paying thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars worth of deductible. This is what the government is cramming down the throats of all the people who love them and support them and believe in them and voted for them and who can't afford insurance. And we're told that, yeah, now is finally your chance that you're going to be covered. Yeah, it's going to be great. No, yeah, your premium is only going to be a few hundred bucks after your giant kickback. And yeah, and your deductible is going to be more than a couple years rent. But don't worry, it'll be fine. And you know what? Line up and vote Democrat some more, because your only other choice is the Republicans. Joke's on us all. And I'm sorry for skipping the break here. I'll let you hear a couple of notes of music anyway. I like these guys. They're funny guys. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right. So anyway, my hope is that instead of just saying, okay, well, now we have to go to single-payer thing, that what will end up happening is they'll blame the intervention. And they'll have to at least repeal this law. I mean, I'm predicting months and months of total catastrophe. Oh, no, and now I'm hearing back from dude, huh? Try again now, he says. Crap. How much time I got on this song? That's a long song. You know what? I'm going to try again. Let's see what we can do here. Wait a minute. Can I cover everything else I want to cover on the show today? Marcy will be on tomorrow. Trevor Tim will be on Thursday. So we got plenty of NSA coming up this week. I think I did get to say what I wanted to about the stupid Obamacare thing. That's probably the last you'll hear from me on that topic for a while. Whatever. Foreign policy is worse, more important thing, at least to me. But anyway, and then I guess I more or less covered everything I wanted to cover on the show. Not everything, but more or less. Okay, so Francis Nesbitt on Somalia coming up. In the meantime, listen to this Mobb Deep and go to scotthorton.org/donate and, you know, give me a little bit of money. Any donation of $100 or more, and I'll send you a QR code commodity disc, which is, I think, should be, anyway, the future of money on the face of the planet. Of currency, I mean to say. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, well, geez. Ah, geez. Busy signal. He says, try again. I try again. Busy signal some more. Ah, well, we'll try for tomorrow. on the show. Hey, listen, I'm sorry that I haven't had Max Blumenthal on about his new book. The problem is I haven't finished it yet. It's really long, and I've had so little time to read books. And damn Facebook and stupid Twitter distracting me from important things like reading Max Blumenthal's book. I'm afraid that I agree with him completely. Almost. But I'm hardly into the damn thing. I can't even say yet. But I do like Max Blumenthal, and he's done great work on Israel-Palestine over the last few years. And the point of his new one is that the Zionist project is completely bankrupt. And again, I'm not all the way through his argument yet. I got a lot of points along those lines to make myself. And yet, you know, I don't know, man. I guess, and y'all probably heard me say this for years and years, too. For me, it's quite easy to picture a counterfactual where, you know, somebody who's not a spoiled, petulant terrorist child like Benjamin Netanyahu could be the prime minister of Israel, and how their country could have a policy, you know, more or less along the lines of trying to be friends with their neighbors best they can. That doesn't mean give up all of their weapons and surrender, whatever. It doesn't even, I don't think, necessarily mean the right of return for all the refugees from 48 and their kin. As unjust as the Nakba is and all of that, I'm just saying, I think that they could get away with, I'm not talking about what's my morality or whatever, what they could get away with would be the green lines. Get out of the West Bank. Hands off the Gaza Strip. Let them have their crappy little Palestinian state. And try to have more or less peaceful relations with the populations, with the neighboring civilizations and nation states. I mean, is Israel supposed to last for, you know, some very short mystical period of time until the Messiah comes and there's a nuclear war and a bunch of crazy stuff, like in a bunch of nonsense? Or is the Zionist project here the one that was created by its socialist, atheist, you know, inventors in the first place, which is a homeland for Jews for the long term? Do they want to have a homeland for the long term, or don't they? The long term I'm picturing means, you know, a few hundred years, right? I mean, how long can one man see into the future? Right? America's existed as a USA type of a nation state sort of a situation here with the Civil War here and there and some problems. But yeah, for 240 years now, something. Okay, so how long is Israel supposed to last? Another few years or for the long term? And it seems to me if they wanted to put their long term interest, their very existence as their priority, then they would stop acting like such jerks all the time. Because their policy clearly, if there's ever been an example in the world of empire being murder-suicide, it's Israel right now. Never mind America. Never mind the crime, the worst crime on earth that is the existence of the U.S. government right now. But just as far as an example of how it works in the microcosm of an empire biting off more territory than it can chew and then destroying itself. It's Israel right in front of your eyes right now. It's ridiculous. And this is why Max Blumenthal says, yeah, forget the whole thing. Because he says they're not going to turn it around. They're not. And you know what? I could have told you this too. Starting in 1996. And you know why? Because I was driving, maybe 97. I was driving a cab and I was listening to G. Gordon Liddy on the radio. And Liddy was saying, let me tell you about the West Bank, all right? The Israelis are never, ever, 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 ever giving it up, period. Just forget it. Take that to the bank. You know why? Because they got settlements the size of Scottsdale, Arizona. And because it's the high ground. And then in their fantasy, military-wise, that matters a lot. And the 67 war was partially launched from the West Bank. And so that's it. And it's, you know, at least to a substantial population of the state of Israel, as Mitchell Plitnik was explaining on the show the other day, this is the real biblical homeland of the Jews. Not even the state of Israel as it exists now. But the West Bank. That's where they're going, and they'll never give it up. They've already got so many settlements there. It would take a, maybe not a civil war, but maybe a civil war just to get the settlements out of the West Bank. And so that's it. They've embarked since 67. Really, that's Elise Blumenthal's argument is they can't turn back now. They're only committing national suicide. In fact, I don't even think he's really recommending that they call the project off. He's saying this is what we're going to see is the failure of Zionism to continue to be a force for the future of the Jews in the Middle East. They blew it. They blew it. The clean break. There's nothing clean about it, stupid. You blew it. You ruined everything. And so, and there's nothing extreme about my position here, too. My position is the exact same position as the defense minister of Israel right now. Now, he doesn't act on what he thinks out loud. He still does wrong anyway. But Ehud Barak, just like Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister, and Barak is a former prime minister himself from the 1990s, and is the defense minister in the Netanyahu government, so even though he's a former labor guy with his own tiny little party now, party of one, I guess, he's Netanyahu's defense minister and not outside that mind frame. War veteran. And Ehud Olmert, the previous prime minister, who was from Kadima, which is an offshoot of Likud, and was Ariel Sharon's party when he broke off from Likud in 2005, so it's not like they're the liberal left-wing hippies or anything. Ehud Olmert, who begged Bush to bomb Iran in 2007, etc., he says the same thing, too, that they are headed toward a situation where it's no longer de facto. It is a just absolute de jure, a matter of no longer deniability, truth on the ground, facts on the ground, as they say that Israel is an apartheid state, a minority apartheid state. Like Jim Crow, but not just Jim Crow in the South, Jim Crow in Mississippi, where blacks were the majority. Or was it Missouri? There are a couple of those states where blacks were the majority and were still treated as the apartheid second, third, fourth class citizens up through the 1960s in the United States of America. And that's where they're headed, just like South Africa was in the 1980s, when the entire world said, this is disgusting, enough. Where the Jewish minority, almost, and I don't know the exact proportions and numbers, but very many of whom, at least a plurality of them, if not a majority of them, are Eastern European refugees from World War II and since, who have no real claim on property in the Middle East whatsoever, not even going back 2,000 years, as the genealogy now shows as well. Have no claim on it at all. It's just a European colony. And again, I think if they really wanted to do it right, they could, by trying to be a good neighbor. But they don't. Instead, they lord it over everybody. They're bullies. And they lie and cheat and steal and bludgeon people over the head and torture children in prison and make themselves miserable neighbors. And their unwillingness to let go of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will be their undoing. And, you know, T-minus a couple of years and counting. Right? How long before so much of the West Bank is carved up by settlements and walls that any prospect that one day there will be a Palestinian state is officially no longer even a plausible, ridiculous lie anymore? Where that becomes just not even on the table anymore as a possibility. And what will that mean? That'll mean that the West Bank is in fact annexed by Israel. And that will mean that the Jews are then a minority, lording it over the Muslim and Christian majority Arabs there. And then at that point, it'll just be a matter of not very long before the politics in Europe especially, but also in the United States, are just going to be too difficult for the Israelis to overcome. And the aid is going to cease, and then what are they going to do? Start another massive war? It ain't going to last for the long term. And that's what Ehud Barak says. And all I'm saying is Ehud Barak is right. His nation state that he is running right now is committing suicide. What a dumbass. Maybe the people of Israel should hire someone to be their defense minister who understands what Ehud Barak is saying, but is willing to do something about it, huh? you know, I don't know. I'm really amazed. I just, you know what? You hear the clip, which I blew the bottom of the hour break, of course, today, but you hear every day on the show, you hear Tom Wood say, so you don't believe the myth of the propaganda of the benevolent, wonderful state that loves you, that they fed you in fourth grade. And at first, I kind of didn't like that because I thought, well, fourth grade, it kind of makes it sound like what you're selling is an education on that level or something. He goes, no, I'm not. Obviously, I'm not. But that is actually the year that they teach you the biggest load of crap about civics in school, because they don't teach it at a high school level at all anymore. And I thought back about it, and I thought, you know what, that's right. It was fourth grade where we learned all about the Senate and this and that and the flag and the Constitution and Abraham Lincoln and Harry Truman and all the heroes. And I remember being incredibly impressed. I actually remember talking about it with the school librarian and everything. Being very impressed about the awesome responsibility. Maybe it was his idea to bring up the topic, the librarian, now that I think about it. But anyway, the awesome responsibility of being a senator, helping pilot the ship of your entire nation full of millions and millions of people, and having it be your job to make sure that everything is okay and stuff. And really, you'd have to be a fourth grader to believe that that is how these people see their job, because it's just not. I mean, rare exceptions, of rare moments maybe on certain issues or something. For the most part, they're all just a bunch of pigs up there stealing and killing. Bunch of psychopaths and philanderers. Not that I'm really against philandering, although, you know, these guys, they're pretty gross. Buy them a steak dinner. They'll sell you a war. They don't care. It's not their money. It's not their son. A bunch of criminally insane. Remember the thing in the Los Angeles Times 2 years back? Psychiatrists do study determine that politicians and psychopaths share many of the same traits. Are you kidding me? In other words, you found a distinction without a difference. In other words, your headline is, some psychopaths get jobs as politicians. Could that be possible? Could it be that in a democracy, the average schmuck would vote for a psychopath to be his leader? Could it be that in our wonderful self-correcting we the people kind of system, that a psychopath could possibly rise to the top and achieve political power? Perish the thought. It's so funny, if you read the article, the dissonance there is powerful. At no point do they say, well, maybe psychopaths are politicians. Maybe politicians are psychopaths. You know, why must we believe that they share some of the same traits? Like, if a psychopath got elected or appointed to high office, at that point, we know that, well, listen, it's the irresistible force. At that point, they become an angel and they start caring only about others as public servants. But some of them could be, you know, sociopathic, rapist, murderer, criminals up until the day before that. Isn't that surprising? What a surprising study we're reporting here in the LA Times. Psychopaths and politicians the same in some ways. Okay, I should move on. You know what? Here's some stuff that I meant to get to. And, you know, Francis Nesbitt is saying, hey, let's work this out. Give me a call again. It's too late, Francis. We're going to try again tomorrow. We are going to try again tomorrow with Francis Nesbitt. But I am going to talk about AFRICOM some more and America's Africa policy here. It's Jason Ditz, who wrote news editor at news.antiwar.com. I do hope you read antiwar.com every day. Even if you just breeze through and read two-thirds of the top headlines, something. Look at the titles of all the rest of the regional news around the world, and at least, you know? If you're not looking at antiwar.com, man, you're missing out. It's such an incredible resource right there at your fingertips. In fact, I'm sure you probably even have like a speech-to-text thing where you can just boss your computer around, and it'll go right to antiwar.com. News.antiwar.com. Training and raids. U.S. prepares African surge. AFRICOM's training, only part of the picture. This is from the 18th. by Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. The U.S. African Command, AFRICOM, keeps trying to redefine itself, but as the Obama administration aims to refocus more and more on involvement in Africa, the plan now seems to be training. Our goal is to help Africans solve African problems, insisted Lieutenant Robert McGee. Oh, man, at first I thought that said Mugabe, but close enough. And they are playing up the idea of training as an alternative to deployment of ground troops. Then there's the ground troops. The U.S. I love the way Jason writes, too. He's funny. Then there's the ground troops. The U.S. has been launching a massive buildup of troops into Italy, putting 13,000 into the nation to be able to launch raids into Africa, particularly northern Africa, at a moment's notice. Man, I told you that if you do a no-fly zone in Libya, that means you own it from now on. Didn't I tell you? That's been AFRICOM's history all over. While the command has long sought to do its own heavy lifting militarily, he might say, the practical matter is that it's been PR cover for military aggression in the region. And by the way, they did another big thing about Benghazi on 60 Minutes. That Lara Logan, who I cannot abide. But anyway, so it was a whole big news scandal. Oh my God, scandal verified about the Benghazi thing. But anyway, I think I even wrote it down what I wanted to complain about this yesterday. What was it? Oh, okay. Here's the big scoop from the new big Benghazi story. And by the way, if you're a right winger, hold tight. This is not any defense of the president or any of his men in any way. Okay? But just wait. So the big new scoop is they were warned. They knew that they were had put this makeshift consulate situation there in Benghazi in danger, that it was not well protected. They had been warned repeatedly from all different people, including their new interviewee. I didn't see it, but I read the transcript of the whole presentation at 60MinuteCBS.com or whatever. And that's it. That's the big revelation. Yeah, but we already all knew that. And then the other thing is that they confirmed that they were told early on that nobody's coming to help you. Okay, well, I guess I have to admit I'm not certain if that exact fact that they were told early on that they were not, that no one was coming for them, if that was brand new or not, but it makes little difference, as Hillary Clinton would say. The point is that we all already know that no one was sent to help them. And I guess it's argued about whether any help was available or not. But they didn't answer that argument in the 60 Minutes thing. I would assume, for my own sake, that they could have saved them, but they didn't want to because they're evil and they think it's funny when people die and they don't care who dies. That's my assumption about the Democrats. Or how about the CIA and the military are tiny little pathetic cowards. And when it's not shock and awe against civilians from 6 miles away, they're terrified to just intervene on the fly. Isn't that what the Secretary of Defense said? Hey, we don't just send in helicopters full of men to see if maybe they can help. We got to have an interagency meeting and a 15-point PowerPoint presentation. And, you know, a week worth of meetings before we decide exactly what we're up against and exactly what we're going to do about it and how many ships and how many Ospreys we have to deploy. And anyway, they're all dead by then. But 60 Minutes didn't solve any of that. All it was good for was reconfirming what we already know, which is they fought the war for the Mujahideen. The whole war. Not that night. Obama didn't do a good enough job being a security force for the security force. The whole freaking war was fought for the Mujahideen. And because they were in denial about that, because they needed to be for PR reasons, they put this ambassador and his bogus security detail right in the center of the hornet's nest in Benghazi in eastern Libya. And said, good luck, don't get stung. And then, when all the stinging started, they didn't come and help them. So, what have we learned? Nothing. We all already knew that. If they were going to do anything about Benghazi that was actually going to be of import, it would be, hey, listen, everybody, Gaddafi, you know, Dick Cheney's good friend, that somehow the Iraq War scared him into going back in time to 1996 and begging to be let back in from the cold. That guy was helping keep Al-Qaeda down. In fact, one of the leaders of the revolution of 2011 that Barack Obama fought for them from the air and the Europeans fought for them from the air was, two of them were proclaimed, self-proclaimed Al-Qaeda and Iraq veterans who fought against America for the Sunni-based insurgency during the Iraq War. And in fact, I think both of them confirmed they fought against America in Afghanistan, too. And that's Hakeem al-Belhaj and, what's his name? Hasidi was his name. And both of those guys, well, let's see, it was Belhaj was actually kidnapped by the CIA and the MI6, brought to the infamous Zubeda torture dungeon in Thailand beneath Bangkok, in some dank dungeon beneath Bangkok, and tortured, and then was sent back to Dick Cheney's loyal ally, Muammar Gaddafi. That evil commie SOB whose one decent thing in the world about him that you could possibly say was that he was good at keeping Al-Qaeda down. He tortured this guy, just like he tortured Al-Libi, tortured to death. Al-Libi, who Dick Cheney tortured into pretending that Saddam Hussein had trained Al-Qaeda how to use chemical weapons and hijack airplanes, which was a total lie. They're pointing at this airbase on a map, but that airbase was there to teach anti-terrorist cops how to rescue a hijacked plane on the ground. You know? How to do a Israeli-style raid on the plane. It was an anti-terrorist training camp led by the infidel socialist Saddam Hussein, as Osama bin Laden called him. Osama bin Laden's a vowed enemy. But, funny thing, Al-Libi's brother was killed by Obama in a drone strike in Pakistan in June 2012. Well, on the eve of September 11th, 2012, like 2 or 3 days before, Ayman al-Zawahiri, hiding out in Pakistan, put out a podcast saying, hey, avenge the death of your martyred brother, Al-Libi, in Pakistan by attacking the Americans in Benghazi. And then they did. And here the Democrats are so caught up in their nonsense about how it's no big deal that they're actually fighting wars for the Mujahideen, for America's enemies, that they actually just go along with their own lie. It's not just PR, and it's not just that they believe it and make their policy around it. They actually will put their favorite ambassador in the middle of the hornet's nest with blinders on their own eyes as to the danger that they're dealing with. Oh, no, these Mujahideen guys, they're fine. Yeah, we're using them to help overthrow Assad now, too. Everybody grab a gun and on the boat. We're going to go have a revolution next up for the Arab Spring counter-revolution by the American Empire, Assad and the Baathists in Syria. Because, hey, that's what bin Laden's rotting corpse wants, so whatever you say, dude. That's the Benghazi scandal. Not one night of no security. Not one night of no reinforcements. Not one unanswered call at 3 a.m. The whole damned war was against a commie, secular, infidel, Colonel Gaddafi. For the bin Ladenites. You know, treason. That's how you can tell that you're a right-winger. I'm the right-winger. Really? Well, listen, if you think that the whole scandal in Benghazi is just Benghazi on September 11th and not the entire war of 2011, which all your right-wing heroes supported, then you're a right-winger. And I don't even ascribe any particular set of beliefs to define that. To me, a right-winger is someone who goes around repeating right-wing talking points that they heard somewhere and don't know nothing, obviously. People who think that the big scandal is not that they overthrew commie secular Gaddafi, who gave up his pretend nuclear program to come in from the cold, who was good at keeping Al-Qaeda down, but just know that one thing happened one night and an ambassador that they wouldn't care about anyway. If this ambassador was a congressman, they would say that he was a commie Kenyan-born traitor who should be taken out and shot, right? They don't care about the ambassador. They're just making up scare quotes. Making up something for right-wing radio hosts to say. That's how you know that you're a right-winger. Is it doesn't mean that you believe in conservatism. Doesn't mean you could articulate what conservatism means. Hardly. It just means you believe what Republican propagandists say. And the test is always simple. You know, something like Benghazi is just perfect, you know? Do you think the scandal is one thing that happened on one night or the entire war for America's only enemies in the world? If you answered the former, then yeah, you're an idiot. Whoa, and look at me, I'm over time. I'm so concerned with insulting conservatives and right-wingers here. I've completely blown the clock. How do you like that? Well, that's the show for today. Thanks, everybody, very much for listening. I will try to do a little bit better job tomorrow.